the problem occurred. Okay, it's like this. You got reason with a small r, and the Greeks had a certain amount of confidence in it. But there was nothing really to ground it. They had confidence in human reason, enough confidence in human reason for people to say, hey, you know, we got to keep studying the writings of Plato and Aristotle and stuff like that. But every once in a while, skepticism would raise its ugly head, and there'd be some questions because, you know, the Greeks never had anything. They had reason with a small r, but they didn't have reason with a capital R. But they didn't have infinite mind to ground and guarantee the existence of finite mind. Okay? So when Christianity became the driving force of Western culture, you know, and the thing was too, Greek philosophy at times was the driving force of Western culture. But that wasn't enough. And so, you know, I mean, first you had the ancient Greek mythology, fairy tales to try to explain things, but at least people acknowledging that the ultimate explanation or explanations of the physical world, of the world of the senses, is in the immaterial realm, is in the spiritual realm. But they were still fairy tales. They were still myths. And so the Greek philosophers refuted those myths. But at the same time, mythology, you know, when the Romans knocked off the Greeks, mythology came right back into the picture. And so, and it wasn't completely gone even under the Greeks. I mean, most of the Greek philosophers weren't heavy into mythology, but the people certainly were. So there was something there that was like, you know, hey, how do we really know that our reason with a small r works if there's no reason with a big r? Well, Christianity provided reason with the big r. Okay? So, that was the guarantee that human reason really works, because God designed it to work so that we really could find truth. So God, the rational God, reason with a big R, he was the gift giver of this gift called human reason. Okay? But see, what happened was we ended up falling so much in love with this gift that we started to forget about the gift giver. In fact, we ended up using the gift of human reason to try to disprove the existence of the gift giver. Now, but that process, and that's what really is called modernism, that process was actually started with good intentions. René Descartes, as a Roman Catholic, wanted to try to prove God's existence and essential Christianity through pure reason alone. Okay? Now keep in mind, at his time, not only were many of the science, the branches of modern science, getting jump-started because of Christianity and, you know, a reasonable God creating man in his image with reason in the universe in a reasonable, orderly manner so that through reason man could find out about the universe in which he lived. So modern science was getting jump-started, all the different branches. Well, geometry, you know, different fields of mathematics, but especially geometry with its axioms, the axioms of geometry that could be proven through pure reason alone, with logical necessity. And Descartes as well as Pascal, they were very versed in geometry and wrote scholarly papers on geometry. And so both Frenchmen, who were both Roman Catholics, were really heavy into these axioms. But where they differed was Descartes was hoping that maybe we could find one axiom, one point of absolute necessity from which we could deduce with logical necessity all truth, including the truth of Christianity. The truths of Christianity. Pascal's response was, whoa, don't hold your breath, man. Don't count on that. That's number one. And number two, his warning to Descartes, which was a warning to Western culture and actually a prediction that modernism, the modern project started by Descartes, would fail and would actually lead to postmodernism. Descartes said, if we could prove everything through reason alone, what need is there for revelation from God? So he was basically saying, look, Descartes, you're trying to prove God and his revelation through reason alone. But if we can prove everything through reason alone and solve all our problems through reason alone, then God becomes obsolete. So in your attempt to prove God through reason alone, you're going to end up creating the biggest, most fierce enemy that Christianity has ever had. It's going to backfire into an argument against Christianity. Basically, Descartes tried to prove everything through reason alone. He was not a skeptic, okay? He didn't throw his Catholicism out the window. He didn't throw his geometry out the window. He was not a skeptic. But he decided to use skepticism as a method and doubt everything until he could find something that was impossible for him to doubt. That would be his axiom, his point of logical certainty, and from that he would try to deduce everything else. I think he came up with a pretty good starting point to a certain degree, but I don't think a whole lot of stuff that he claimed he was deducing from it, that it didn't really follow with logical necessity. But anyway, the more he doubted, the more he acknowledged the existence of the doubt. Okay? So, and doubting is a form of thinking, so he said, I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. So, from that premise, he then tried to prove everything else, and I don't think he really, even at one point, he comes to the point where he realized the whole world of senses, supposing God is actually a demon who wants to deceive us, and the whole world of senses is there to confuse and deceive us, not to lead us into truth. But then he argues, oh, but of course God is good, so he wouldn't deceive us. And then he moves on. But that's not, he didn't prove that with logical necessity. Okay? So in other words, I think that there is somewhat of an assumption there that it is not proven, but I think it's a good assumption. And it's basically, he's assuming the basic reliability of sense perception. But we have to, just to live, we have to assume that. And but whatever the case, with René Descartes started modernism, which was the attempt to find all truth with certainty through unaided human reason. I am all for using reason, but traditional apologists before Descartes, and most traditional apologists after Descartes, will use reason, but they won't use unaided human reason, okay? They'll use reason plus the senses and plus, you know, a lot of times, as Christian apologists, we do not have to start where Plato and Socrates, Aristotle started. If God gave us the answer sheet already, okay, we can start with God's answers. And so, basically, with God's revelation, that could help and aid our reason to make a better rational defense of Christianity. But modernism is the attempt to find all truth with certainty through unaided human reason, and it's also an attempt to solve all of man's problems through unaided human reason. So, in other words, through technology, we're going to save this planet. By the way, the contemporary modernists are called secular humanists today. You read the Humanist Manifestos number 1 and number 2, and then Humanist Manifesto 2000, which is authored by Paul Kurtz. It was his organization that got a hold of me from Buffalo, New York, to debate Jeff Lauder at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill campus. And I got to meet Paul Kurtz there at a big atheist conference. But the organization he heads they are kind of the final vestige of, you know, the remnant of modernists who still think that through unaided human reason we can solve all our problems. And it's, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, get it through your heads, guys. For every disease that we cure, we find another, we'll figure out another way to blow up the world, or, you know, whether it's biological warfare or nuclear warfare or whatever. I mean, technology is a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. And whatever the case, if modernism is correct, then revelation from God would no longer be needed. And but the fact of the matter is that modernism failed horribly to find absolute truth, okay, and to solve man's problems. And so what's occurred because of this modernism has given way to postmodernism. Modernism, you have rational arguments, they're worthwhile because there's such a thing as absolute truth, okay? But modernism has failed so miserably that rather than return to pre-modernism and Christianity, postmodernists say, well, they're, you know, reason doesn't work. Reason doesn't work. Because there's no absolute truth. And since there's no absolute truth, we don't have rational arguments, are a waste of time. Instead, all we have are power narratives. Okay? What they're saying is, all we're doing is telling stories. There is no meta-narrative, no all-inclusive story that is true for all people at all times and all places. So all we can do now is tell stories. And really, since reason is thrown out the window, all that's left is the passion, the emotions, the will. And so if you can tell a story that makes enough people cry, you can win them over, but that's a power narrative. Your narrative isn't really true. It's just you chose. You wanted it. You want it to be true, so you gather around it. Political correctness is a baby, one of the babies of, one of the offspring of postmodernism. You have the gay community gathered around their own narrative. The feminist community gathered around their narrative, you're not going to see rational arguments, okay? Instead, you're going to see attacks on, Bill Clinton was our first postmodern president. And if you disagreed with his view, he wouldn't rationally defend his view. He would attack your person. Because he chose his views not through his reason, but through his passion, his will. Okay, and postmodernism rejects absolute truth and human reason's ability to find truth, and it focuses on meaning, feelings, will. The last stage of modernism, because modernism had this autonomous, you know, self-governed, unbiased, rational individual. Okay. The very last stage of rationalism, of modernism, was reason was thrown out the window, but you still had the individual who knows that there's no truth, knows that reason doesn't work, and all you got left is the will, so you just, the individual takes a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm and actualizes themselves. And that's called existentialism. The difference between existentialism and postmodernism is the postmodernist says, you know something? Even the individual taking a leap on their own is still modernistic. And if anybody thinks that they are an independent thinker, they fail to realize how influenced they are by their culture or their community. And so in the end, postmodernism throws out even the unbiased individual and says each one of us is a product of our community, which gathers around a narrative, okay? And the postmodernism is so crazy that a book like the Bible, the readers, a community that reads the book, has more say into what the book means than what the author intended for it to mean. So, you know, we wonder, well, how can gay theologians go to the Bible and argue that Jesus came to earth to liberate the homosexuals? And it's obviously not true. Well, yeah, they'd be the first to admit, yeah, it's obviously not true. But there is no such thing as truth. So we are free to come up with our power narratives. And it's not, you know, are we rightly interpreting the Bible or any other book? The question is, how many people have we convinced through our power narratives to accept our narratives and to want our narratives? Okay, so that's what political correctness is all about.
So that's how talk radio DJs work, that are annoying, and they're postmodernism arguers. They argue from the exception rather than the norm, the exception being what they believe is truth, and it doesn't matter what. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's some of it. All depends on which talk show host you're talking about stuff. But sometimes, there's a blend of modernistic thinking and postmodern thinking, and you know, because it all depends. Because modernism was real big on individual rights, but since modernism threw out God, there was really no basis for those rights. But standing for individual rights ended up, since absolute moral values got thrown out the window, it ended up becoming, instead of being my right to be all that God called me to be, without you forcing your will on me, instead of that, it became my right to partake of my sinful behavior without any condemnation from you. So all of a sudden, human rights were viewed as that which sets us free to be good Christians and to be good citizens. Human rights then became perverted to mean the right to sin and not to be judged as a sinner by others who disagree with me. And but now in postmodern times, that's taken on, you know, has taken on epic proportions now. It's kind of with pre-modernism, with Christianity, okay, you had God's moral absolutes, okay? Under modernism, that led eventually to the view that there are no moral absolutes. So it was moral relativism. What's right for you is right for me, it doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. The problem with most Christian thinkers is we're still fighting that today. That is not the predominant argument coming from the schools and coming from the you know, the universities and the media and from political leaders. We have now gone from not just from God's absolutes to no absolutes. Now we've gone to the stage of what William Watkins called the new absolutes. You know, it's the new tolerance. Okay? So in other words, it's Isaiah 5:20, right before God lambasted Judah through the Babylonians. they had reached a point where God had to say in Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Look at Romans 1:18 through 32, the stages of decay of a nation. First comes the rejection of God. That leads to idolatry because we've got to worship something. That leads to immorality. But the final stage is when not only do you do these evil things, but you encourage others to do them. And you end up with this political correctness movement. Well, that's new absolutes. It's the new tolerance. The old tolerance used to mean that, you know, I as a Christian tolerate and am willing to die for the religious freedom and the freedom of speech of a Muslim to disagree with me. But religious freedom and tolerance means that I can say he's going to hell unless he converts to Christianity, and he can say I'm going to hell if I don't convert to the Islamic faith. That's what tolerance was all about. Now the new tolerance, and Josh McDowell and Bob Hostetler wrote an excellent book on the new tolerance, and it's all based on the new absolutes. Now the new tolerance says that you have to believe that all religious beliefs, in fact all beliefs for that matter, are equally true, and all behavior is equally acceptable, or you are intolerant, and you know, then they imply your property needs to be confiscated, you need to be imprisoned, and maybe you need to be executed or whatever. Well, what that is saying is we have a new religion, and this new religion tolerates no competitors, and we will kill anything in our way. That's not tolerance. So the new religion of tolerance is probably the most intolerant religion of all time. And then it's all, you need an anti-intellectual postmodern base for anything like that to even sound respectable. Okay? And, but you know, it's basically, you know, Nietzsche said God is dead. And then Nietzsche acknowledged, well, because God has been thrown out the window and Christianity is no longer the driving force of Western culture, well, then truth is dead as well. And morality is dead as well. And that's what postmodernism is really basically Nietzsche's thought unfolding the consequences of a world without God unfolding, you know, right before our eyes. The saddest thing of all is that even Nietzsche didn't realize that that also means that if God is dead, then man is dead. Schaefer called it the death of man. Lewis called it the abolition of man. And in the attempts to fight for gay rights, in the attempts to really stand up for the person who's been hurt by traditional morality, traditional views, in the attempt to stand up for people, in actuality, we're dehumanizing people. We're defending sadomasochism. We're defending criminals instead of the law-abiding citizens and their victims, and it's going to get to the point where governments are just going to, you know, big government is just going to enslave everybody. But you know, basically Nietzsche argued once truth and reason are thrown out the window, once rational arguments are thrown out the window, all that's left is shouting. And you know, Nietzsche understood that if there is no truth, all that's left is man's will to power. That old Greek philosopher Thrasymachus, might is right. And that's what postmodernism takes us to. Is reason, thinking is thrown out the window, so it's the will. And it's the ones who have the strongest wills and want the power, they are the politically correct, and they force their views down our throats with a passion. And you either become part of their community or you face their wrath. But it reduces all authority to power. This purple handout, we don't have time to look at it today, but maybe we'll go a little bit further into postmodernism the next time we get together. We just need to move on right now. But the purple handout talks about, you know, God told us to worship him in spirit and in truth. So the spirit speaks from the depths of one's being, and in truth, in accordance with the truth God has revealed. Christianity is both propositional truth plus personal relationship or personal experience of God, the Hebrew Old Testament tended to emphasize the will, the emotions, narrative, poetry of the Old Testament. The Greek New Testament tended to emphasize theological thought. You know, Paul wrote so much of the New Testament and all. So, but the Greek New Testament did not throw out the spirit aspect of the Old Testament. It just emphasized the truth. Yeah, incorporated both, but it emphasized the truth aspect, whereas the Hebrew Old Testament emphasized more the spirit aspect, but it didn't throw out truth. And, you know, God was mainly known as his personal God in covenant with the nation of Israel. But the statement, he doesn't exist, the Hebrews would have said, well, that's a false statement. So, I mean, they didn't throw out absolute truth. And so we may, you know, when you deal with a modernist, you may have to focus on the Greek New Testament rational thought. You know, the four spiritual laws of Campus Crusade for Christ. When you deal with a postmodernist, you might have to bring back the gospel and its all its beauty, because after all, it is the greatest story ever told.
Windenbar power narrative.
Yeah. But the thing is basically get them to desire, appeal to their search for meaning in life, their will, their emotions. See, what we've done is, because we were influenced by modernism, we've turned the gospel, the beautiful gospel message, into a very boring set of propositions. And what we need to do is to regain the beauty of the gospel narrative. Without even trying to do this, without even thinking about postmodernism, New Tribes Missions does this just by, when they preach the gospel message to foreign tribes, they take them through a survey of the entire Bible. And so basically they're preaching the gospel in narrative form. And the thing is, those tribes that they're preaching to never heard of postmodernism. But guess what? They think like postmodernists. And why do they think like postmodernists? Because they're pre-Christian, they're pagans. Pre-Christian in their thought. And in other words, when I say postmodernism, a lot of people think, oh, it's the newest thing, it's the hottest thing, and you're a Neanderthal. All postmodernism is, it opens the door to the myths. Because, I mean, when they say, well, Christianity isn't true, yeah, well, atheism isn't true either, and pantheism isn't true, nothing's true. So all we have are stories, all we have are myths. So the floodgates are open for the ancient myths and neo-paganism. You know, postmodernism paved the road for a return of paganism. So, I mean, if somebody told me in the 1960s that in the 1990s there'd be Americans who would be bowing down and worshiping rocks, I would say you're crazy. But the atheistic secular views of the 1960s, eventually, I mean, you know, you profess to be wise, but you become a fool and you bow down before statues of four-legged creatures. Romans 1 still stands. But whatever the case, because of this postmodern rejection of truth, we may be called upon, as we witness to our friends, to defend truth and man's ability to know it. Listen real closely to the people we're talking to, because the question might not even be raised. You know, it is becoming more and more common where you think you lead your friend to Christ, and your friend goes to your church, especially if your church is really, you know, a church with young people, and they play contemporary music. I mean, real, real contemporary music, like some of the churches in Seattle, and it appeals to the young college age students and stuff like that. You might think you led your friend to Christ, and then 6 months later, you find out that all he's claiming to have done is that he believes Christianity is true for him. He doesn't think it's true for all people at all times and all places because he doesn't believe in absolute truth, but he has chosen by his act of the will. He's a postmodernist, whether he knows he even heard of the term or not, and he's decided, I want to be with this community and accept their narrative and live like it's true, but I really don't believe anything is true for all people at all times and all places. And so there are actually, we're getting more and more cases like that. Not so common over here, but you get by University of Washington, where there are some postmodernists, and it's becoming more and more common for people to say everything right. There was a pastor out there who had to fire his entire praise and worship team. It was after his praise and worship team was leading praise and worship for about a year in his church, all of a sudden he found out they didn't believe that Jesus was literally God incarnate and the only Savior of mankind. They just believed it was true for themselves because they wanted it to be true for themselves. It was the narrative they were gathering around, but they rejected it as a meta-narrative. So he had to fire the whole praise and worship team, and half of his church wanted to leave with them. And well, so he spent a whole series of sermons defending absolute truth, and then he said, I want to let them know that I'm not the only guy who thinks this way. So he brought me in, and that's when I came up with my message on truth and knowledge, which eventually became, chapter 4 and No Other Gods.
Sounds like his bands are like videos too.
What's that?
It was kind of like videoism then. I'll believe it. It's in my world. It's fine with me. If you don't, you know, what was that? Live, let live.
Yeah, the it's interesting that you mentioned fideism. Fideism really fits well with existentialism in the modern category, and there are, just as there are a lot of similarities between postmodernism and existentialism, so too fideism has a place in postmodern circles. The only difference is postmodern fideism is a fideism with teeth. With fangs, in fact. So in other words, it's like, number one, your leap of blind faith is not taken alone. It's taken with an entire community gathering around this narrative. But then number two, if we get enough people to accept our narrative, we're going to force it down the rest of the world's throat with passion.
I'll believe the myth because it makes me cry. If you could bug me, you're intolerant and I'll die.
Yeah, and it's one of those deals where it's not, well, you just got to believe, and if it's true for you, you know, and then walk away. It's the postmodern thing is, you know, if I get enough people to accept my narrative, we will rule, because that will to power comes in. There is no reason to stop it. And whatever the case, Schaefer's Line of Despair is an example. Now, Schaefer was dealing with existentialists, but it applies as well to postmodernists. Schaefer showed that in the thought of Immanuel Kant, Kant showed that we could... by the way, I don't mention Kant here. But basically, Schaefer's saying that modern man, and we can call him postmodern man today, has abandoned the idea of absolute truth. He started with Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant argued that we could know reality as it appears to us, but we couldn't know reality as it is. Kant's argument would be, okay, say my mind has an idea of this table. So it's like taking a photograph of the table and happening in my mind. How do I know that that's an accurate depiction of the table? Simple. Well, I just take the photo, my idea of the table, and I compare it with the table. Problem is, I don't get the table. I get just another photo of the table. You never do reach the table. And so basically, the rejection of the God of the Bible led to Kant's wall. I think Kant is the apex, the climax of non-Christian philosophy. Because when you have unaided human reason, and then you can't even wrote the Critique of Pure Reason, okay? When you have unaided human reason, when you say, you throw God out the window and you just do human reason on your own, you build your own Tower of Babel, in the end, you erect a wall between reality as it appears to us and reality as it is, and there's no way to bridge that wall. Now, if you acknowledge the existence of the God of the Bible, then it only makes sense that reality as it appears to us and reality as it is are very closely related, if not, and they're one and the same when we do know the truth. Okay?
God's the ultimate.
Yeah, and God created us with mind, in His image, with minds, for the purpose of really knowing reality as it is. Not exhaustively, and not knowing everything, because we're not God, but we can know everything, we can know truths to a limited degree, and we can know a limited number of things. Whereas God knows an unlimited number of things, and He knows each one of those things exhaustively. Okay? So Kant, you had this Kantian dilemma. Okay? Now, Hegel refuted Kant, but just set the process even further in the wrong direction. Hegel basically said, well, the statement, man can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. Is that a statement about reality as it is, or reality as it appears to us? Because if it's only a statement about reality as it appears to us, then who cares? It's not a statement about reality. I'm too busy to just talk about, you know, appearances. But if it's a statement about reality as it is, then we can know reality as it is. And so Hegel said, we can know reality as it is. That sounds like a great victory for philosophy, but not really. Because in Hegel's thought, the world of ideas was the real world. And Hegel came up with, rather than, Schaefer says, he left the realm of antithesis, which is the law of non-contradiction. A cannot equal non-A at the same time in the same way. You know, something can't be both true and false at the same time. I'm not both man and non-man at the same time in the same way. Hegel was pictured as saying, and Schaefer understood it this way, it's actually a misunderstanding of an oversimplification of Hegel, that there is a thesis, there is an idea that reigns, like in the history of philosophy. And then there would be a rejection of that antithesis. Okay? And the two ideas would battle it out. Like in Greek philosophy, they said, reality is being. Okay? Reality is that which remains the same. And then others would say, no, reality is becoming. Okay? It's change. And then others would argue, no, you're both wrong. And they'd be synthesized, so you could reach a synthesis. Reality is both being and becoming. Okay? There has to be being that becomes. I am a changing being, but I am a being. And though Phil Fernandez experienced a lot of changes, he's still Phil Fernandez. Okay? Now, in reality, Hegel, in the preface of one of his books, comes right out and says, this is an oversimplification of his view and his view. In other words, there might not just be one thesis, there might be several. There might not be one antithesis. There might be several contrary views. And then some of them might even have some similarities with it. It might not be a direct contradiction of it. But out of this mess, something gets synthesized, okay? And so he saw God as history, and history as a process, God as unfolding himself, and God as truth, so truth as unfolding itself through history. So in the end, when everything's said and done, he replaces the idea of the law of non-contradiction and absolute truth with synthetic synthesis. So in the end, what you have is something that was true yesterday wasn't true in the fullest absolute sense. That's at the end of the road. But even in any sense that it was true yesterday, it doesn't have to be true today. It could be synthesized into a new truth. Okay? Now, Marx took this idealist, the dialectic, this is what it's called, this process, and out of idealism and put it in materialism. So he was a dialectical materialist. So, and that's where he came up with his view of communism and all. But, and by the way, he accepted the misunderstanding of Hegel and all. But see, what you have here is Kant, you end up with agnosticism. Man really can't know truth. You end up with Hegel. Well, there really is no absolute truth, because what's true today might not be true tomorrow, and truth is unfolding itself. And so then you come up with Soren Kierkegaard, and you know, with his Christianity, he said, we talked about him earlier, but it was like religious truth ultimately isn't in the realm of reason anyway, in his thought. It's in the realm of non-reason, so you have to take a leap of blind faith. He's the father of modern existentialism. You have to take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm to create meaning for your life. And so, in his view, what's important, it's not important whether or not Jesus really rose, and that's an objective truth. What's important is that you subjectively believe with passion that he rose. So your subjective beliefs are all important, and what is objectively true isn't important. A later existentialist said there is no objective truth. Kierkegaard didn't deny objective truth, but he just said it's not as important as subjective beliefs. Now keep in mind, he was trying to combat and refute a watered-down Christianity that was head knowledge only. People who just held the creeds, but their lives weren't changed. They didn't have a vibrant faith. Same time, he threw the baby out with the bathwater, swung the pendulum so far in the other direction that it was irrelevant if Jesus was God. It was irrelevant if Jesus existed. It was irrelevant if he rose from the dead. As long as you passionately believe those things and allow those subjective beliefs to transform your life, that's all that's... So in other words, instead of saying belief and practice are both important, to those who said belief was only important, Kierkegaard said practice is only important. And he tried to use the example, you know, God told Abraham to sacrifice his son. It was the same God that said, thou shalt not kill. So ultimately, when you deal with God, our reason doesn't work, and there's contradictions there. No, God's just testing Abraham. That's all he's doing. There's no contradiction with God there. But basically, the shapers of the modern mind, Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, it led to the idea, it led to modern existentialism. Life is absurd and meaningless. There's no absolute truth. Man can't know truth, and therefore we must create meaning for our lives. That's the optimistic view, like Jean-Paul Sartre. We've got to actualize ourselves, create meaning for our lives. But the pessimistic side is the nihilistic side, nihilism. Well, if everything is meaningless and chaotic, why take a leap of blind faith? Why not just despair? Okay? And so Schaeffer showed that, you know, what he called modern man had thrown out absolute truth. Now, basically what I want to say is this. The key here for us, well, you know what? I should bring up Gordon Clark. Yeah, before we get to those other two points, let me bring up Gordon Clark. Oh, man, we're out of cassette, too. I'll tell you what. It's almost 9 o'clock anyway. Don't leave as skeptics. I'll just give you the conclusion real quick, and then we'll pick it up. We might not be able to get together next Friday, but the Friday after we'll get together. We'll pick it up with Gordon Clark to show that he shows non-Christian thinking always leads to skepticism. Okay? But the two things we have to argue for is that there is absolute truth and man can know it. And guess what? It's easy to argue for. The statement, there is no absolute truth, if that statement is false, who cares about it? But if that statement is true, then it's an absolute truth, so it self-refutes itself, and it has to be false. In other words, absolute truth must exist. And then to say, well, okay, well, maybe man can't know it. But the statement, man can't